Welcome to Condensed Histories. This is Jem, and this is one of these episodes where I'm on my own. And as I said in the previous one of these, what I've decided to do is actually spend each one of my alone times with you. Thank you very much for allowing me to fill your ears right now. I appreciate that. With my books, because I have written about 10 of them. Now, in the first one, I didn't cheat a little bit, but let's just say I gave you extra value for money. I mentioned one book in passing. That's the one I'm going to be doing a lot more on today. But I talked about my very, very first book and how it led into another book. So that was all to do with British history, British Empire. But the very first book I got properly published was Deus Vult, A Concise History of the Crusades. And what I want to do is, I mean, yes, I mentioned it a little bit in that previous podcast. Don't worry, I'm not going to just say exactly the same stuff. But actually where I'm going to first start off with is the slightly unusual bit about the history of the Crusades. Don't worry, that wasn't me stammering. What I'm talking about is the Crusades are an example of how history changes as society changes. I'll give you perhaps a slightly different example. Let's talk about the Vikings, shall we? So in the 19th century, they were seen as sort of brave pagans, and the Victorians slapped horns and wings on their helmets, and that wasn't a thing, really. But that was the image that seemed to indelibly stick with us. And it was very much about them being brave warriors, and, you know, there was lots of stuff about the raping and pillaging, but basically about the martial aspects. But then, in the 1960s, there was a big pushback against this. They pointed out quite correctly, look at the Viking longship and how technologically advanced it was. It was very shallow, which allowed it to go up and down major rivers, like the Volga, for example. It allowed the Vikings to found places like Kiev as a sort of trading post. Every major city or ancient city and town in Ireland is actually of Viking origin. And yet these ships were also able to sail across the Atlantic, and these were the first Europeans in North America. All this is super impressive. And so they talked about the arts and crafts and the culture and society. And this evolved in the 1970s and into the 1980s. And if you like, the Vikings were so rewritten by the early 1990s, there was then a further pushback where it was basically, look, yes, they were very good boat builders. Yes, women had extremely strong rights for women in Europe during this time. But it's almost like we've emphasized the farming and building and shipyards so much, we've left out the axes and raping and pillaging, which they undeniably did. So, if you like, depending on when you were learning about the Vikings in universities in the 20th century, you would have got quite a different view of them. Now, the reason why I point this out is because the Crusades are a far more heated debate. So I first started learning about the Crusades in the 1980s at school. As I said previously, I'm one of the last people to actually have a medieval history GCSE. But because of my heritage, my father is Turkish, and you keep hearing about the Turks in the Crusades, and everybody else in my family is sort of Western European, there was a little part of me as a kid, you know, a teenager, where it's like, well, I just can't lose any Crusades, because if the Christians win it, I can lean on my Christian heritage, and if the Muslims win it, well, I can lean on my Muslim heritage, so the Crusades were a win for me no matter what. Now, you're probably sitting there going, well, that's very insensitive, but the thing is, the Crusades were, in essence, ancient history in the 80s and 90s. Nobody cared about the Crusades. The only time I saw them being mentioned in any kind of political thing was actually during the First Iraq War. Now, bear with me on this, because this is a long journey on this one, But as this coalition was looking to throw Iraq and Saddam Hussein out of the invasion of Kuwait, that the whole world agreed was a bad thing and should absolutely be turned around, there was an article in Time magazine, a famous American political magazine, which compared the potential invasion of Iraq and Kuwait with the Fifth Crusade. Now, at the time, I was reading about the Crusades, and it's sort of like, I just did not see how a modern army with air forces and amphibious landing craft and automatic weapons, smart missile systems, etc., how that can really be compared with cavalry and infantry and bowmen of the Middle Ages. And also, it's worth pointing out that whenever people start talking about the Crusades with the Middle East, the Crusaders only ever worked in the actual Middle East, in modern day Syria, Turkey, Israel, Palestine, and that's it. And the Fifth Crusade didn't even get there. It was in Egypt, which is technically on a different continent. We can argue that the culture of Egypt is more similar to the Middle East than, let's say, Ghana. But the fact is, it is, I'm going to argue, nearly 1,000 miles away from Iraq. So I had no idea why that writer decided to make that comparison. It, under the most basic of scrutiny, it didn't work. I guess they were just trying to come up with a slightly different angle to yet another article about imminent war in the Middle East. And as it turned out, that first Gulf War had no resemblance whatsoever to a crusade. Now, this is the thing. In the 1990s, people like Richard the Lionheart were only associated with Robin Hood and not really with the Third Crusade. And what exactly was the Crusade? It just was not part of the collective consciousness. Until the 11th of September 2001, when the most devastating terrorist attack in history was inflicted upon the United States of America. And I, like everybody else of my generation, watched on TV as the Twin Towers collapsed, killing thousands of people in New York. And at the same time, we were hearing about how the Pentagon, the nerve center of the most powerful military that has ever been seen on planet Earth, was in flames. America was under attack by religious zealots, and suddenly religious war was at the front page again. And ever since then, politics and extremists of both Christian and Muslims have reached back to this era of the Crusades and repurposed it for their own means. And that is pure and simply bad history. The opening of Deus Vult is actually a quote by General Eisenhower on the eve of D-Day, when he describes what these thousands, hundreds of thousands of Allied soldiers who were about to go into Normandy and sort of France as a whole, and described it as a great crusade. Now, nowadays, and this is the point I'm making in that first chapter, nowadays that would be absolutely unacceptable. George W. Bush just once mentioned crusades, and he was not a particularly good public speaker, but he never mentioned them again, because they are problematic. For years in the West, the word crusader meant a noble endeavor, putting effort into a just cause. Let's face it, one of the catchphrases for Batman, you know, he's also known as the Dark Knight, and he's also known as the Caped Crusader. That one isn't really used much anymore, because the Crusades now, as sort of come into the public consciousness, we can understand that the Christians did plenty of bad things compared to the Muslims. But this narrative of it only being Muslim and Christian is wrong. This idea that Muslim and Christian are guaranteed to have some kind of fundamental clash of civilizations, again, does not stand up to scrutiny when you start looking at the Crusades. And indeed, somebody pointed out to me when I started promoting Deus Vult on Twitter using the hashtag Crusades, somebody said, you really need to have a look at what other people are doing. And it is a load of Christian fundamentalists basically saying, kill all Muslims, which is Islamophobia, pure and simple. But also you get really, really dumb memes going, I see your jihad and raise you a crusade. Well, I hate to break it to you, but the Western Crusaders got kicked out of the Middle East. Ultimately, the Crusades in the Middle East, at least, failed. So I wouldn't raise them a crusade, because you're going to lose. But all this garbage needs to be swept away. As I said in the previous one, I don't write any of my books just to jump on the bandwagon. I write my books because I figure there's a gap. And the problem with the Crusades is, apart from some very academic works, I can't think of a single book about the Crusades that genuinely covers all of them, not just in the Middle East, but the ones that happened in Europe as well. Not just from 1099 to 1291, but from period after that too. It gets a little bit complicated, and in a way, it's not hard to argue that the Crusades aren't a separate topic if you're studying medieval Europe. They're part of the culture of medieval Europe. So, allow me to take you on a bit of a journey. I start in the first chapter about how the West used to see Crusades, and sort of in the 20th century, and then how it all changed with 9/11. But then I go back to the teachings of Christ. You see, most other religions compared to Christianity have something in there about how to conduct war. But it is quite obvious in at least the New Testament that violence is to be avoided. You know, Jesus himself preached a mission of peace and love, of turning the other cheek, of, you know, even when he was betrayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, it was not to sort of like attack Judas or, you know, attack the Romans coming to take him away on the cross. And indeed, he was to sacrifice his own mortal flesh for the good of humanity. Now, I don't care whether you believe that or not. Personally speaking, I'm not a Christian. But it's a powerful message about sacrifice, peace, and love. So how do you get from there to killing in the name of Christ? Because if you read the New Testament, there's just nothing there. Old Testament, dripping with it. And indeed, if you go to things like the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata and the Quran, you know, all these other religious texts understand there will be times of conflict and basically put in the rules to what they pretty much do every time is say, protect the innocent, no need to kill unnecessarily civilians, and if you're going to fight an enemy army, you need to engage them with fury, but you need to, if you like, show them respect, and you know, you should take prisoners and things like that. I mean, even the Quran, I find this one interesting, that it makes a specific case about olive groves, because I had to dig this up. Olive groves never die, you know, unlike your daffodils in your front garden, you got them for a couple of weeks and then they're gone. You know, apple trees and pear trees can last for a couple of centuries, but olive groves, it takes them a long time to grow and to reach maturity and start bearing fruit, i.e. olives. But after that, they just keep going. There are literally olive groves in the Middle East that have been bearing olives for thousands of years. So therefore, to destroy them is to destroy the local economy. Olives are incredibly important. Olive oil, olives as a garnish and part of cooking is a fundamental thing in the Middle East. So weirdly, it's sort of like tearing them up, according to the Quran, is a war crime up there with massacring civilians. Because in a way, you are sort of stopping that local population from eating or from trading, you know, which is a long-term crime that's unacceptable. So yes, in the first chapter, I talk about this evolution of just war in the West. And cutting a long story short, it is a thousand-year story. You get a lot of time for your bucks in this particular book. But if you think about it, after the collapse of the Roman Empire, well, first of all, you know, Jesus, it's very easy for him to say turn the other cheek because Christianity isn't coming with an army or any power. But once Constantine starts associating Christianity with the Roman Empire, well, then you can fight for Jesus. And that's literally what he did to get to power. There's the famous Battle of Milvian Bridge. And, you know, he held up a banner of Jesus at the critical moment in the battle, and that sort of scared the enemy. And at that point, Jesus is being used like Ares or Mars, you know, these sort of pagan gods of war. Jesus was used in a battle, which is not what Jesus should be used. Now, for the record, Constantine wasn't even baptized until he was on his deathbed. He was not a Christian. He wasn't doing this for Christ, but he recognized the Roman Empire was beginning to break up. So how do I glue them together? With a faith, with a common belief. And so that is the main reason why sort of the Roman Empire became Christian. And at which point, you know, you have an army, in theory, of Christians. And so, yes, that's the starting point of it. Then later on, you got the collapse of the Roman Empire, you got the influx of all these sort of barbarians, I'm using that in inverted commas, like the Angles and the Franks and the Goths and Visigoths and Vandals and later on the Vikings. And these people showed no mercy to the local Christian populations. So the Christian populations had to protect themselves. So a defensive battle to save the local population, to stop everybody being murdered and slaughtered in the church, I don't think God's going to have a problem with that. But we are now literally raising our arms in the name of Jesus. And it was that evolution from, first of all, the Roman Empire's got an army and they're still going to have to fight, to we need to defend the borders from the pagans, to the hit-and-run raids of the Vikings, to eventually we are going to need to sort of like claim land back for Jesus. So that's the evolution. But meanwhile, in the East, you had the Eastern Roman Empire, which throughout the era of the main Crusades is now called the Byzantine Empire. But one of the late Eastern Roman emperors was a guy called Heraclius. And what he did is he was very much a military leader. And the Persians, who at that time were not Muslim, because the Islam hadn't quite kicked off yet, they were Zoroastrians. They prayed to Ahura Mazda. There was this sacred flame. So this is very much not either Christianity or Islam. And they came smashing in to the Eastern Roman Empire, and they took Syria and large chunks of the Middle East, including, critically, Jerusalem, which had been rebuilt by the Romans and had become very much an epicenter of Christian understanding. This is quite obvious. And what Heraclius did is he inadvertently invented the concept of a crusade. And what is a crusade? Well, it's basically you get rid of all your sins, and in return you get to go to heaven, but you're going to have to fight for God. The church absolutely backs this military endeavor. And critically, the church is part paying for this military endeavor. And with this, there was very much the goal, just like in the Crusades, we've got to claim back Jerusalem. What's interesting, of course, is we're more than halfway through all this podcast, and I haven't even got to what most people consider are the Crusades. So just to wrap up Heraclius for a moment, he successfully carried out this campaign. He recaptured all these areas. He basically reconsecrated Jerusalem as a holy site. And he was very successful. But then later on in his career, for the first time ever in any either Byzantine or Roman history, there was a massive explosion of military expansionism and empire building coming from an area that had never done that in the past. It was from the Arabian Peninsula, and there was this new military force called Muslims. And it was indeed at this time, it was Heraclius who was the person who was to lose out when it came to Islamic expansion. And in the space of just a couple of generations from Saudi Arabia, basically, you have an empire that spreads from Pakistan to Portugal, unbroken,
across the whole of North Africa. The French had to fight a battle. It was Charlemagne's grandfather, Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, who fought a decisive victory against the Islamic Caliphate that stopped France falling to Islamic powers. Areas like Sicily, which you consider absolutely part of Europe, was to be Muslim-ruled for centuries. And, of course, sort of like well-known, you've got Spain and Portugal ruled by Islamic powers, again, for centuries. When you consider that they came into the Iberian Peninsula in the 700s, and some areas of Spain were to be under Muslim rule until 1492, that means that they were ruling these areas for more than 700 years. So if you then add 700 to 1492, that means some areas of Spain still, if you just look at the total spread of time, still have spent more time under Muslim rule than under Christian rule. That's how embedded it was in the Iberian Peninsula. So I'm going to stop there, and now I'm going to fast forward to, shall we say, the more common Crusades. So in the 1090s, you can see this is hundreds of years later. Again, I don't want to get in too much into the behind-the-scenes politics of all this, but you have the famous Council of Clermont. This is in France. And basically, the Pope, Urban II, he declares this concept of an armed pilgrimage. Now, this is contrary to what a pilgrimage was. The whole point of a pilgrimage was it wasn't a threat to any person. And pilgrims would travel across countries through, sort of like, in theory, enemy territory or into different nations. And therefore, they weren't meant to carry weapons. But then, at the same time, you were definitely going to go to hell if you attacked any pilgrims. But this idea was to reclaim, an interesting word, to reclaim Jerusalem for Christ. Now, Jerusalem had been under Muslim rule since the time of Heraclius. So we are talking about, you know, give or take 300 years, certainly more than 300 years. And it had never been directly ruled by the papacy from Rome. So it was a slightly odd sort of start to this. More in that, I go into far more detail about that in the book, but this excited everybody in Europe. You see, fundamentally, if you're a knight, your job is to kill people, and it does say, you know, one of the Ten Commandments is thou shalt not kill. But now what the deal was this remission of sin. What does that mean? That means that if you go and fight your way to Jerusalem and reclaim Jerusalem, you will have the slate cleaned. You have no sin upon you whatsoever. You are guaranteed to go to heaven. And this is at a time when in Europe, people took their religion very, very seriously, and people were genuinely worried about their place in the afterlife. So this was picked up with a feverish enthusiasm across Europe. It did have some very horrible side effects. For those poor people in Europe that could not travel or had no military skill to travel into the Middle East, they wanted to do their bit for God. What did this lead to? These are some of the examples of the earliest and nastiest massacres of Jews in Europe. It didn't just happen in Germany, but it was particularly prevalent in Germany. But it absolutely happened in France and England and elsewhere as well. Terrible, terrible side effect. The basic logic behind that is, well, if they're not Christians and we kill them, isn't that a bit like doing a crusade? I mean, there's no justification to that whatsoever. So with the First Crusade, and it was never actually called that by the local people, or the people on it, I should say, they travel. I mean, some of these people literally walk from somewhere like Paris to Jerusalem. That is a remarkable undertaking in and of itself. But if you think about it, basically once they get into Anatolia, modern-day mainland Turkey, or the Turkish bit in Asia, from then on, they're basically in enemy territory. And again, cutting a long story short, this campaign went on for years, literally years. But as they marched across the sort of the arid sort of central plains of Anatolia, they were attacked by local Turkish groups. There's the Battle of Dorylaeum, where there's the classic sort of Asiatic horse archer attack. So pretty much throughout this the Crusader era in the Middle East, you have two completely different uses of cavalry. The West had heavy cavalry, male horses, actually not covered in armor. That was to come much, much later. That was never part of the Crusades. But you have a large male horse, and on the back of it, you have a man, a knight, covered head to foot, basically in male armor. Chainmail is what people commonly term it. And underneath that, they actually had a padded jacket, a gambeson, which sort of like stopped the shock absorber of being hit by a mace or a sword. But it also sort of reduced the efficacy of arrows as well. There are examples of like men who kind of look like hedgehogs, just sort of peppered with arrows, but none of them have actually hit them. And they usually would have had a full face helmet on as well. So that is what the heavy cavalry of the West looked like, usually armed with a lance or spear, and would have had a sword as well. But that's not what the Islamic horse archers were. And I'm using the term Islamic because the Muslims called the Crusaders Franks, but they didn't all come from France. And quite often you get the Crusaders calling the Muslims Turks, but they certainly weren't all Turks. There were plenty of Arabs involved in this as well. But both, you know, all Islamic cavalry basically was the same. You have light cavalry, light horse archers. So the horses were actually female. The men themselves would wear perhaps leather armor or maybe no armor at all, would have had a small circular shield strapped to their arm so that they could use for sort of like a certain amount of defense. They would have had a curved scimitar, and they would have had a composite bow. And these people would charge around their horses, quite sometimes in circles, just peppering the rather more sort of sedentary Western forces with arrows. And sometimes they would feign retreat, which would lure the Franks into a charge, and they might get ambushed at that point. And this was sort of going on consistently as they marched through modern day Turkey. And then they arrived at Antioch, one of the great cities of the East. And there was basically a siege for about a year. And the Crusaders only just managed to win the siege before the relief army turned up, and then there was a battle of Antioch as well. Now, most of what we know this from multiple sources. There's actually a woman, the daughter of the Byzantine emperor of the time. Her name was Anna Komnina, or Komnenos. And so we have an entire chronicle written by a woman, which is incredibly unusual in the Middle Ages. But you also have the Gesta Francorum. This is written by an anonymous Crusader knight. And so you have this first-hand account of what it's like being a Western knight going into the exotic Middle East. And make no mistake about it, to most of the men on that first crusade, going to Jerusalem, in their minds, was akin to going to heaven on earth. Eventually, 1099, the Crusaders get to Jerusalem, they besiege it, they attack it, and again, against all the odds, they successfully get in. And what happens next is one of the largest, most bloody massacres in Jerusalem's long and bloody history. Yes, these Crusaders decided to, in essence, sort of go on a frenzy of violence, almost baptizing these holy sites, places like the Holy Sepulchre, you know, the most holy Christian church in Christendom, bathe them in the blood of the population of Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem was not just a Muslim city. There was a large Jewish population, and there was a large local Christian population. Sort of Orthodox Armenians, for example, would have been in the area. There would have been other Nestorian Christians, etc. So the point is, we're not quite sure what the exact motivation was, but we know that Muslims, Christians, and Jews all perished under the swords of the Crusaders. That's the first crusade, and I don't want this to be a four-hour podcast, you'll be pleased to hear. Basically, what happens after that is you then have these crusader states, these Christian states set up in the Middle East, but they happen. It was just blind chance that the Crusaders came in at a time when there was a power vacuum in the East. So what you've got for the next 200 years is the Muslims reuniting, and as soon as they do, they have substantially more power locally than the Crusaders do. And so they start very quickly start chopping away some of the territories. The first one to go is the county of Edessa, which is, you know, exactly where it is in modern terms. It's sort of on the Iraq-Iranian Turkish border. That's kind of where it would be in modern terms. That falls first. So a second crusade is sent out. But the problem here is this is led now by kings. So kings are definitely going to go home. The first crusaders, they turned up and most of them stayed. And we now have a king of Jerusalem. We now have a prince of Antioch and other such titles. And so you have a, sort of like a ready-made army. But this time round, what happens is the crusade turns up. And it's most of it's going to go home after it's done its job. But also they pay no attention to the local needs and they decide to attack Damascus, which was the only Muslim ally of the Crusaders in the area. Now, I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of all this, but bottom line, listen to that phrase, Muslim ally. What you see again and again is this alleged idea that the Crusaders and Muslims hated each other. And make no mistake about it, violence absolutely happened. There were massacres on both sides. But there was far more talking, far more truces, far more peace treaties than you would initially think. Both these sides talked to each other. Whether they respected each other is a completely different story. But even the most zealous crusader understood that you could do a deal with a Muslim. By the time we come to the Third Crusade, everything I was talking about the sort of amassing of Muslim power under sort of like one leader, as it were, had come to a critical point. The entirety of the Crusader states was wiped out except for one city. Jerusalem had fallen, and this is all under the famous Muslim ruler Saladin. He was a Kurd. And what happens with the Third Crusade is the Crusaders manage to win back some of the territory, but not Jerusalem. But they sort of stabilize. It goes from a crisis, almost this is the end of everything, to a diminished size of territory, but at least the territory is back again, so at least some of it. Then you've got the Fourth Crusade, and the idea there was we're going to send ships over to the Middle East because that's easier than sort of marching everybody over to the Middle East. We'll get the Venetians to build us an entire fleet, but they overestimate the amount of people who are going to turn up for this one. The Venetians say, pay us, and the Crusaders say, we don't have enough money, and the Venetians say, okay, well, then we're going to use your army. And so the Fourth Crusade never actually makes it to the Middle East. They attack Zara, which is now in modern-day Croatia, and the local population was all Christian. They hung banners of the cross outside their city walls to remind the Crusades that you're fighting Christians here. The Pope was so incensed by all of this, he actually excommunicated the Crusade. So now the Crusaders aren't actually Christian, which is, this is a whole huge mess. And it culminates in the sacking of Constantinople, the capital city of the Byzantine Empire. And actually, for a time, the Byzantines aren't running Constantinople and the much diminished Byzantine Empire. And it's actually the Latin Empire of Constantinople for about 50 years. And this was an incredibly embarrassing thing for the Crusades. And then around about the time of the Fourth Crusade, we get the Albigensian Crusade. What the hell's that, Jim? This one doesn't even have a number, and this one goes on for decades. Indeed, while the Fifth Crusade's going on, the Albigensian Crusade is also still going on. There were sort of various bouts of it, but there was this rise of heresy in France. And this is the idea of heresy. So if you, at that time in Europe, you were Catholic, and therefore you had to do what the Pope said. And if you didn't do what the Pope said, but you were still Christian, that made you a heretic. You were basically, in essence, politically against the Catholics. And so they're seeing they could raise armies and have things like inquisitions, which were principally originally set up to try and reduce the amount of heresy out there. These very violent processes were used in France. This went on for, as I said, decades. This was a real war. There was some horrific violence going on at places like Carcassonne and Toulouse. And there's the famous one where the Crusaders break into one of the towns, and their cry goes up, "How do we know who to save and who to attack?" Because these are all obviously French people. They all kind of look the same. And so the papal legate, this is literally a man of God, gave the order, kill them all, for God shall know his own. In other words, if we kill everybody up in heaven, they'll do a sorting system. The heretics go to hell and the righteous people go to heaven because they sort of died unnecessarily. That is just a horrific war crime. But that was a war crime perpetrated by Christians on Christians in France. Nothing to do with the Middle East. And so we get the Fifth Crusade, which, because the power base of this Islamic empire was in Egypt, the idea is, let's attack Egypt. Makes sense, but we're now a long way from Jerusalem. That one goes pretty well until they flood the Nile and then everything bogs down for the Fifth Crusade. And indeed, most of it gets captured, which is incredibly embarrassing. Sixth Crusade, we get the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, turning up in the Middle East with not many forces, but the Muslims don't know that he's not going to get reinforcements, and he negotiates. The Sixth Crusade has no violence whatsoever in it, and he manages to negotiate Jerusalem to be given back to the Christians. Now, the walls had to be torn down, and this was sort of widely condemned in Europe. It's like, why didn't you fight them? And his response is, hey, I got Jerusalem. Isn't that what we're here to do? So you can see how the Crusader state thing, the whole Crusader movement gets muddied pretty quickly. It becomes all kinds of messes. And then finally in 1291, we get the every single city in the Middle East has fallen to this new Islamic empire called the Mamluks, and there's just Acre. And Acre has an amazing defense system, but nobody in Europe comes for their help. They call out Henry II is both the king of Jerusalem nominally, although he runs Acre, and he also runs Cyprus as well, and he keeps asking for military assistance from the West, saying, look, this is it, we need help now. And the Pope is so busy with affairs of Europe, he doesn't send a crusade to save Acre, and Acre is captured by the Muslims in 1291. A huge army is sent against them. The Templars, the famous military orders, haven't really mentioned them, but these were basically knights who acted like monks, but rather than praying for God, they fought for God. And so you can see that all this is swirling on, and you can tell this is a particularly long podcast, sorry about that, but this is the sort of the tip of the iceberg, and you can see that the Crusades are a very exotic, very interesting idea, and you can't really understand the Middle East without understanding the Crusades, but you also can't understand medieval Europe without understanding the Crusades. If this has sort of piqued your interest, if you're sitting there going, I'd love to know more about that, or you certainly skimmed over that pretty quickly, well, yeah, there's the, I think it's about 85,000 word book called Deus Vult, A Concise History of the Crusades, which takes you into far more depth about all these things, which is what this podcast ultimately was about. I think you can tell I'm quite passionate on this topic. I think also importantly, you can't overlay the mindset of these Middle Ages people into the modern world. And so nothing in the modern world is really like a crusade. Sorry about that. And yes, I hope you've liked this. We will be having another podcast. This will be one next week. It'll be both Greg and Jem together. Yay! And we'll be talking about stuff. Thanks for listening, and speak to you soon.